Among the rain and light I saw the figure five, in gold on a red fire truck, moving tents unheeded to gong clang siren howl.
Chris, looking at your webpage, I'm struck by how eclectic you are, employing among other styles minimalism, neoclassicism, serialism, atonality, polytonality, quotation music, and so on. Is there a Chris Ludwig sound amid this variety? If you were to tell your friends what to listen for in the music of Williams' songs, what would it be? What would you direct them to?
I would say early in my composing career, I wouldn't say there was a Chris Ludwig sound. It was a matter of exploration to figure out what was my sound, who was I, what was my style. And that takes quite a few years for an artist to develop. It's not something that happens in a year or two. And it wasn't until really I started writing a great deal of woodwind duets, and when I started writing art song, and of course large-scale keyboard works, that I really got a sense of who I was. And that style would be very certainly influenced by my woodwind writing. That is, a lot of ornaments, figurations, decorations. A lot of my earlier training was based in counterpoint. So I tend to be very strong and rooted in two-part writing and three-part writing. And so I found it quite natural to pair singer and piano together, simply because in essence it is kind of a two-part writing. A lot of the piano parts I write may be just two voices, one bass and one treble, with the pedal utilized to fill out, of course, the effect of six-part textures or bigger. And it's not a matter of piano ability. I've developed my piano ability over the years. When I was in university, we were in something called PSL, which is Piano Second Language, as we called it. So I didn't learn piano as a young man. I started as an adult. Maybe that influenced my piano writing a bit, certainly earlier on. But as time went on, I think I developed a fixed style. I mean, some people tell me that they immediately know it's a Chris Ludwig piece when they listen to it. I was once told at university by my composition professor that I was the only student in the music school that wrote fast music. Mm-hmm. Writing slow music is good because you can have a longer piece with less notes, but I've never been one to take the easy way out. So in terms of what a listener should listen to in my music, because of my two-part writing background, the piano part and the vocal part are connected together, and that is, they both often share ideas and share melodies. So we call that imitation, or we call it often transference, where, say, the voice sings a line and then is transferred to the piano and it will play the same line, or changed, or vice versa. The piano part will have a melody or an idea, and then the voice takes it over and does the same thing, or maybe there's some space in between those moments. But certainly that would be, I guess, common in my style. My harmonies, I find I'm attracted to open intervals like perfect fourths and fifths, quartal and quintal harmonies a lot. That's something that you'll see in a lot of my pieces, is a standard stack of fourths, C, F, B flat, E flat, that kind of stuff. I like that openness, the sort of a glowing hollowness that happens when you do that. Or also, spread out major ninths, that kind of stuff I really, really like. So there are certain commonalities in my harmonies, I think, that stick out through the whole works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Flute is your major instrument, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. And I was wondering if that's affected your compositional style for piano, maybe even for voice. I was thinking particularly that figure that we often hear in your music, the ta-ta, either a 16th dotted eighth, or maybe a 32nd followed by a dotted 16th, but it's ta-ta, ta-ta.
Well,
ta-ta,
something I've done very
it's
different.
It's almost like the flute. Boop, boop.
Well, the flute stuff is often grace notes, and grace notes and ornaments happen usually before the beat.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, of course.
What I tend to do almost universally is my ornaments start square on the downbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than having Daya is Daya, which is a very different...
Right on the downbeat.
Yeah, right on
gives
square
a stronger, downbeat. Gives a stronger...
Yeah, it's more snappy,
and
more precise.
Right.
I think it's a wonderful thing to have a style of your own.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say it's pigeonholing yourself, something that you can't escape from, that you cease to grow and develop, and you're now stuck at a plateau, but I don't see it that way at all.
Yeah.
I see it as having arrived, and you can then develop in an area that is truly you.
Mm-hmm. I noticed this thing, at times it would happen on a word, might be a, say the vowel would be on the short note, and then the end of the word would be the on the longer, so it's not what a singer's used to, so you kind of... In a way, it becomes a problem of communicating the word and also achieving what you want to achieve musically with that snappy kind of rhythm, which I think makes sense a lot of times for the poem. But it can be a bit of a challenge trying to, because usually as a singer you're used to, you know, the main emphasis of the word, like water, for example, water, rather than water, water.
But how, if you speak it, though,
yeah,
you wouldn't say water.
True, water, yeah.
You'd say water.
Water, that's true. Particularly when you're pointing to something, you want it, if it's there, yeah.
So I've always erred on the side of things being as phonetic and as speech-like as possible.
Okay.
As opposed to, as you say, bel canto.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always a tendency to singers, I guess, to a certain degree, to think back to the old bel canto style. I mean, this we're all originally trained in that, but so much of modern music isn't about the beautiful line with the rubato in the middle and that kind of thing.
You know? I would still say the majority of our songs that composers are writing now are still slow-tempoed,
yeah,
longer-winded stuff in some ways. Not saying the pieces are longer-winded, but the gestures are longer-winded.
Yeah.
There's a certain timidness to kind of let things fly. Mm-hmm. Well, Canadian composers are apparently notorious at writing slow music. As opposed to, I mean, that's a difference between American and Canadian composers, so that's a horrible thing to say.
That's interesting. You're just canoeing along.
Yeah, maybe it's the culture, right?
Well, you talk about developing a style as a sense there of a temporal process, and you've just got off talking about word setting. What have you learned about setting words to music since your earliest efforts up to the Williams songs? What trajectory do you see yourself as having taken in that regard?
I'm not going to go far as back as university, but I will go back to my first recording, which is Outward Voyage, that Cliff and I did. I would say that the intricacies of the bond between piano and singer, I think my pieces now are stronger in terms of the piano writing and the way it interlocks with the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that I'm able to be a little bit more varied now when treating words. And also I think there's more diversity between songs than I think I used to write.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I think the complexity of the music is a bit more now, and my craftsmanship certainly is much, much higher than it was back then. But I think there's always a tendency for composers to not listen to or reject the music they wrote many years ago because they saw it as they were learning it's inferior, it's, you know, not as good as who I am now. But I think that's a dishonor to who you are, because without that past, you aren't who you are now. And they had a beauty unto themselves. And even if it's an innocent thing, an innocence and naivety, I may not be able to capture that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you have to enjoy where you're at, what period of, you know, your artistry you're in.
The next question is for Cliff. You've been talking a fair bit about your response to this material as a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know what you do contribute to an art song besides simply supplying the voice. Do you see yourself as a conduit with most of the meaning lying in the score? Or do you allow yourself a significant degree of interpretive freedom? And if you do, what's the nature of that freedom? I suppose it all comes down to what is it that you aim for in performance, vis-a-vis a particular score.
Yeah. If that's okay with you, Harvey, I'd like to address it particularly in relationship to these Williams songs.
Yes,
rather than art song in general or how I might approach other art songs. Because I think Williams is somewhat a particular case. When you say, what else do you contribute besides the voice? In a way, that's an interesting question for the Williams art songs, because I'm going to take a rather maybe radical position here. Williams said, no ideas but in things. And he was very caught up with the actual sound of the word as a thing, a concrete thing, you know, that had edges to it and contour and whatnot. So I tried to approach the Williams songs as my voice in its sound as a concrete thing. And that's what I wanted it to reach people's ear in that way, as a concrete thing. And then, of course, if something reaches your ear, you take it into your brain and you translate it, and there's all sorts of cognitions that come out of that, right? But rather than thinking in my own mind of just, you know, certainly I think about the poem and how I want to approach it, you know, interpretively and stuff. But it all comes down to the voice and that concrete thing being projected out there to the ear of the audience. And then it's up for the audience to make of it what they will, for it to conjure up either an image in their mind, like Williams' wheelbarrow that we never set, or whether it is to make other associations to deeper meanings, to more cognitively complex meanings. It's not that I didn't think about those things when I read his poems and what they brought up for me and what he was trying to say. And in some of his later poems, he's pretty obvious in a lot of ways what he wants to say. He has the poems during the 30s, for example, as I was talking about before, and his experience in dealing with the poor and that. I mean, he's obviously writes with a conviction and stuff. But when all's said and done and I get up and I sing, it's the voice, and I don't necessarily want to do too much of just straight conscious cognitive interpretation. There's a subtle difference here. Okay?
If you're focusing on the voice in that way, do you focus on what it is you are producing, or are you focusing on matching what the score is telling you to produce as closely as possible?
It's got to be in the score, for sure.
It's
certainly helpful if it's in the score. The composer has already written rhythms and pitches and has the piano doing certain things in relationship to your voice, then it certainly will help in how that voice is sounding to people's ears, how they encounter that thing of your voice and what it's likely to evoke. You sullen pig of a man! We sit hunched together, brooding our fate. You know, they're different. But you encounter my voice in a certain way.
But whose voice is it? Is it you, the singer? Is it Williams? Is it the composer?
It's me. It's how I react emotionally to that. And it's not like, okay, I'm going along here and I want to create this effect. Get ready for this effect. It's not that. You've got to somehow connect with it as a hard-edged thing and trust it and go for it.
I guess it doesn't matter what the audience sees, whether it's you, Cliff, singing the songs. In fact, this is you conveying yourself, or is it you conveying the composer's music, or is it you conveying Williams' voice?
I don't think
it matters.
I think, frankly, I like to just say his poems. I like the sound of them. I like the thing of them. And so maybe that made it easier. I mean, only the listener can tell. Who knows? They may not get it, and it's all in my mind, but that's the way I felt about Williams. Is it wasn't hard for me to where I had to consciously think, I better get prepared to make this effect.
Right.
But I don't think it's necessary to try to tell the listener how they should interpret something or how they should think. I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
Poetry itself is so individual that every individual can come up with their own meaning.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of your contribution, Chris, What roles do you assign to melody and to harmony in setting a text? What's the relation between those two in terms of your creating one of these Williams songs?
Sometimes I can see the melody and harmony are the same thing, and that may be a strange thing to say.
It is.
But in contemporary music, sometimes the melody can be buried within the piano part. Or, I mean, it's obvious if the vocal part is singing a melody, it sticks out. But in the case of a lot of stuff where it's a recitative kind of writing, that isn't really melody. And so if the piano has the melody underneath, melody is still present. And the melody becomes an underpinning. But the melody, if it's not in the forefront, can become lost in the harmony. Mm-hmm. Similar, if you listen to a lot of piano writing of, say, Debussy or even Chopin, the melody is not always sticking on the top, mm-hmm. in the right hand. It can be in any voice. Mm-hmm. And that can be a challenge, because sometimes as a listener, you'll have to listen to something many times to get that, you know, all of the content out. Because you can listen to something from different points of view. You can listen to it from a harmonic point of view or a melodic point of view. And mm-hmm. I do believe from a practical point of view that the piano writing should reinforce the singer. I'm sure many composers would disagree. But I think that your melody or pitches that the singer sings should be reinforced in the piano so that they don't start their entries all by themselves. They don't have to pick pitches out of the air. Similarly, you know, starting after a piano interlude or a big leap, I think it's important to reinforce that. Sure, singers can do it. You know, they can pull notes out of a hat. I don't think they should have to.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to make, as a composer, your music such that singers don't want to do it. Or they'll do it begrudgingly, and then that's the last time they'll ever want to hear your music.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it doesn't sound like, wow, that was an amazing high wire act as he did this really modern, cutting edge piece, you know, that really impresses me technically.
However,
you don't want to get there.
Now back to melody and harmony, there's no reason why the vocal melody cannot outline a harmonic idea. For instance, let's suppose you're using, and I talked earlier about quintal and quartal harmonies, which are stacks of fifths and fourths. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why the voice can't move down in a sequence of fifths or fourths,
yeah.
or sing their leaps in open intervals, mm-hmm. so that the harmonic content and the harmonic color and language, the voice is part of that.
Right.
They're not speaking different languages, the voice and the piano.
And I'm happy if it helps to facilitate the thing words, sung thing words getting out there to people's ears, and it stimulates hopefully at least a portion of what Williams intended in that poetry. Of course, poetry is such an enigmatic thing.
We don't
always know what everything is, but if we can get a bit of it, mm-hmm. it's really satisfying. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think poetry needs help and new music needs help, so maybe the two of them can combine their resources.
Yeah.
Well, a minute ago, you used the term recitative for some of the vocal writing that you've done in the Williams poems, and I was surprised by the use of the term recitative. I would expect that you would be talking about, well, except I know the songs, but one expects more, perhaps, lyrical vocal writing than you provide in these songs. A lot of it, I guess, could be called recitative. What makes you decide when to use recitative? Why do you use it? And when do you use something? And why do you use something that is more lyrical?
Recitative can have many uses and many practical uses. One is if you have a huge amount of text and you want to get through it, recitative is the way to do it. That's from a practical standpoint. But also it gives a more speech-like, it's more natural to reading. It's more, as if someone's speaking a poem. It is, for Williams, his poetry is not lyrical a lot of the time. Sometimes it is, but it isn't, a lot of it isn't inherently lyrical, so why would you use lyrical writing for it? So to me, that makes sense. But also for clarity of text, a lot of traditional art song is very difficult to discern sometimes at a concert because it is arioso or aria. It is long lines.
As a singer, I did find that in regards to the rest of the T, that there is a recitative-like quality to a lot of the songs, but it's not the rest of the T that one might encounter, say, in operas, particularly early operas, where you have the harpsichord there, it gives a chord, and away you go with your rest of the T. Even there's a certain amount of freedom in that. Your recitative seemed to have more of a quality of like an accompanied recitative, and you're very particular about the rhythms. I mean, you've got to pay attention to those 16ths and 32nds and
quintuples and septuples.
All that, you know, and so it's doing that and getting the natural quality of the word and the communication and the thing-like quality of the word out there. And my sense was, because it's kind of an accompanied recitative and there's things going on in the piano, and even though it may feel like just speech and recitative for me, as long as I stay on task with the rhythm and pitch and all that kind of stuff, the fact is there's things going on in the piano under me all the time. And my sense was your particularness about my staying in these exact rhythmical sequences was because you wanted it all to line up. And singers don't always think of that, particularly when they hit recitative portions. You know, they figure, oh, well, I can just kind of go with a certain naturalness here.
Well, as an instrumentalist, I'm used to playing things rhythmically complex and exacting.
Yeah.
And certainly the piano players that we've worked with mm-hmm. prefer exacting notation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want any second guessing.
Right.
You know, remember, one of our piano players likes to follow the metronome markings I give to a T.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not nice to you if you choose to deviate from
that. Oh, well, I work it out with the pianist, didn't it? Yeah, no, they were great.
Well, they're fantastic pianists.
Yeah. I mean, that's another point. It's probably getting off topic a bit, but it does relate to this in the amount of rehearsal and working together it takes to put something like this together, because it is very exacting, and I think it's probably characteristic of music in the modern era that, it is very exacting. And
was it 2 years to produce the recordings, or a year and a half?
Oh, at least two, yeah.
At least 2 years?
Yeah. A pretty intensive work on all our parts, yeah.
Well, I think the score...
And it took a while just to record it, yeah.
I think there's over 250 pages of score.
Yeah. That's a lot. Yeah.
Well, you two have been talking about the importance of rhythm and lining up the voice and the piano. And I'm curious to know more generally, Chris, what roles that you assign to tempo and rhythm in these songs?
Tempo is part of the expression of the moods and emotions of the words. I mean, if you have something increase in tempo, it completely changes the interpretation of the poetry. The use of rhythm it changes the interpretation of the poetry. Slowing down, speeding up, it all affects that. If you slow down quickly, you increase speed quickly. If you cadence and then slam into a new tempo, you know, adds a major amount of drama to it. Similarly, if the words are spoken slowly or sung slowly, mm-hmm. if they are sung rapidly or depending on how they alternate, it's also used for contrast within a larger song, because it's a bad idea to have a 10-minute song, because there are a few song cycles in these albums that may be 9, 10 minutes or longer. If you go at just one tempo and one rhythm, it's going to be very tedious. Certainly a poem doesn't stay tedious in that fashion.
No,
Williams doesn't.
No.
You know, leave a 50 or 100 line poem, right. You know, all of the same rhythm and same mood.
Right. Yeah. The accompanist, this last question applies here too, that, you know, in performing it, there's two of us in the room there. And unfortunately, we don't have the two pianists, who are Anna Babilova and Tatiana Kvatova. I spent a lot of time with both of them and working out this whole thing musically. And it's interesting, the interaction, you know, how we work out these rhythms, how we kind of work through a song and how we figure out what we're going to do with it musically. Yeah, they're equally, and sometimes with your music, more involved in the whole musical unraveling and problem solving. So I was just thinking, I feel a little, there's only one half here. We're missing the pianist, and mm-hmm. what an important part they play at every level.
And they have their stories, too.
And they have their stories, too. Boy, do they ever.
I know. Tatiana had an interesting story where I was actually talking to her daughter, and her daughter was saying, yeah, I hear all these noises coming out of her practice room.
She didn't tell me that.
And she says, oh, she's complaining all the time about the difficulty and what she's having to go through, so...
Poor thing.
Yeah. Well, she said actually she got used to it. And
yeah,
it
right.
made sense. So.
Yeah, but yeah, well, when you're rehearsing this stuff, yeah, it's new to the ears and can at times sound noise-like, and probably is noise-like what we produce. But
and sometimes you guys will learn something incorrectly and make it needlessly hard on yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember Tatiana once, she had. Missed the fact that I had done clef changes.
Yeah.
So her fingers are all playing in a mash together in a ball on the same notes.
Yeah.
And she starts saying, is this what you really want?
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it and go, I think you're in the wrong octave here. Did you see the clef change? And the uh-huh. amount of exclamation marks that came after the word oh.
Yeah.
Just the utter shock.
Right. Yeah. How can I put this? That in preparing this music, and I think this applies to a lot of music that's written today, you got to take something which sometimes is going to be perceived as new music. It's going to be perceived as somewhat unfamiliar to your audience. And as you're preparing it as performers, we're always thinking in our minds as well about how are we going to make this work? How are we going to sell this? And how are we going to sell it when we got Chris there, who's real stickler and wants his music, you know, da, 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 da. And there's a little bit of, you know, pulling stuff, and we experiment with things, and a little bit this way, that way. You think he'll accept this? Oh, hell, well, who cares if he accepts it? Let's just do it. See what he says.
And then you pay the price.
But there's a lot of that. So, again, I've been fortunate with two pianists that are so well musically educated. And
Anna said something very interesting to me. After you had the music that I gave you, the first volume, mm-hmm. The music itself, the art songs, I wrote in 7 volumes. Mm-hmm. She told me that when you asked her, I think it was you who asked her to accompany you, mm-hmm. she said, oh, I thought new music, great, I'm not going to enjoy this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not going to be any fun. I don't know if I want to do it.
Yeah.
And then she says, oh, this is not so bad. This actually makes sense.
Oh, yeah. No, I think she discovered very quickly that we have a composer who knows what he's doing.
Well, so. I wouldn't go that far.
Most of the time.
A standard feature of music, of course, is the use of repetition. In the operas that I know and the songs that I know, the texts are written with the music in mind, and the texts provide repetitions for the music to capitalize on. Williams doesn't use repetition, but you have, I won't say imposed it on him, but you have used it in quite a number of his songs. Now, is that coming from your sense of the demands that music makes, that music wants repetition, or was it something in the poems that you felt had to be reiterated, even though Williams hadn't done that?
Repetition actually can be a somewhat of an evil word for some new music composers. Repetition is unsophisticated. It is, I guess, a sign of... it's an inferior composition if you use repetition, because that means you sometimes can buy into traditional forms, and you don't want to buy into traditional forms because then it wouldn't be an avant-garde piece. Then it would be maybe have a tint of classicism or romanticism in it. But as for repetition of words in the music, I've done that for a number of reasons. I think of the Defective Record, where I repeated build a house, on to build a house. I did that because I wanted to reflect the sort of hysteria or the rapid move of humanity and people to build and build and build and build, and sort of that reckless abandonment and hysteria. I thought by repeating that rapidly, that phrase over and over again, it would enhance the poem to do that. Sometimes I'll repeat words because I want to provide my own meaning of the poem. I have my own emphasis when I read the poem, a particular line that I find very compelling. And if I find a word or line compelling, I want to use it again. Sometimes I might even repeat a word because I think it's funny. Nothing more than that.
Yeah.
Just a tangential question. I know you yourself are a poet. Do you use repetition in your own poetry? Or does that simply come out of the process of creating the music for Williams?
No, I don't. I don't think I'm, as a poet, as free as Williams. But certainly my stanzas are uneven, not to the degree that Williams are. He can have really large stanzas. So I don't see myself as using repetition as a poet either, but certainly I can follow a consistent tangent, so to say, as a poet.
Okay.
Yeah. I experienced your repetitions by and large working for me. It was almost like, if you read one of Williams' poems, then you obviously have thoughts after it. It goes back to that thing I was talking about, no ideas but in things. So the words, they conjure up sort of thoughts and images. And so you bring that back at the end, and it seemed to create a mood. It was a way of repeating certain musical themes, of providing a closure. It seemed to work. Occasionally, I had some problems with it, but I would generally go with it and see if I could make it work. And I know on one particular poem, and I never really took this up with you at the time, because I think I had a different experience of the poem than you did. So I think what I did is I thought, well, I'll just prepare it the way Chris has written it and then see if I can come to accept it and make it work. I'm saying this because I think the way you said it at the end, it did work. But it took some thought on my part about how am I going to bring in what I think about the poem versus how you've written it at the end. It's a portrait of a lady, and it's the one where you use the 6-6-8, you're fine, da-da-da-da, and then there's that bit in the middle, but, you know, it's a change of register, you know, what sort of man was Fragonard, and this kind of stuff, and then you get back to this nice little da-da-da-da-da-da.
It's interesting, if I may interrupt for 1 second, say, what kind of man... I heard in the singing of that, what kind of, I didn't hear that impatience.
Okay, I wish you had, because obviously it didn't come across, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah. I didn't have that envision.
Oh, okay, because I meant to kind of interpret.
Because I was surprised.
Listen to it again.
I had to say, that was my intention, is it actually the way you, Harvey, are interpreting it.
Yeah, it's the, well, so read though, your thighs wrapped with blossom, touch the sky, which sky? The sky where Watteau hung a lady's slipper, your knees are southern breeze or gust of snow. Ah, what sort of man? There's a frustration there.
Yeah, that
what sort of man was Fragonard? You should have gotten it. If you didn't, it didn't work on my part. As if that answered anything. Ah, yes, below the knees, then it comes back. Since the tune drops that way, one of those white summer days, the tall grass of your ankles flickers upon the shore, and then it stops. Which shore? You know, which shore are we talking about? The sand clings to my lips. Which shore, for God's, you know.
That's exactly the way I read the poem.
Right. Well, if I remember, which shore?
But I tried to bring that across in the way I sang, and maybe it didn't reach the ear sufficiently enough. And I thought your composition in the middle there was fine. I mean, if it didn't come across, it was because of somehow I didn't emphasize it enough. But I wasn't trying. I was trying to convey that. Mm. Ah, petals maybe. How should I know, right? That's what I wanted to say. Which shore? I said petals from an apple tree, right? That's the way I wanted it.
Yes.
But what he's finished it with, he brought the line back from the second line in the poem, "Whose blossoms touch the sky," and made made it all romantic again,
yes.
and sort of in one way threw the poem away. But
well, it was both lines. I saw petals from an apple tree whose blossoms touch the sky.
Yeah, we'll have to look where. But there is that very lyric line there. So I thought here, how am I going to do this the way it's written? So I tried as much as possible, but not enough, to sing, I said petals from an apple tree a little bit stronger. And then right after to say in a more lyric kind of, you know, afterthought kind of way, whose blossoms touch the sky. But I had a hard time trying to interpret the poem the way I read it.
And one thing that probably gives trouble now and then is I don't have the phrases necessarily match with the lines in the poems.
Yeah.
So that I may have the phrase extend halfway into the next line and then the next phrase start in the middle of the line,
yeah, right.
Which is not the way Williams wrote it.
Right.
But the reason why I would do that is because, again, my interpretation is different,
yeah,
or I want to bring out a different meaning. Yeah. And I don't feel obligated to.
I thought your interpretation for both, the only thing that bothered me in a way with your interpretation is you're bringing in that repeat and making it a romantic poem at the end, when it really is about his building frustration of trying to come to terms with which shore. It's like Europe versus America and apple trees versus Fragonard and Watteau. How does he bring these contrary parts of himself in a way together? And we did it the way it is. And I thought you did musically in the middle where, the Fragonard and all that kind of stuff. I thought you did provide music that I could be a little bit more dramatic and declarative about it. And if I wasn't, then that it would actually reach the audience, then that's my deficiency. Yeah.
Blossoms touch the sky, which sky? The sky where Watteau hung a lady's slippers. Southern breeze or a gust of snow. Ah, what sort of man was Fragonard? As if that answered anything. Yes, below the knees, since a tune drops that way. Of your ankles flickers upon the shore. Which shore? The sand clings to my lips. Which shore? Ah, petals, maybe. How should I know? From an apple tree whose blossoms touch the sky.